Cool. I guess you can start by introducing yourself, giving us a little bit of a background.
Yeah, definitely. So I'm Jack, one of the co-founders of Sherlock, or I guess early core contributors of Sherlock. Sherlock's been around for almost 3 years now. It was started kind of in late 2020, early 2021, with myself and Avert, and we came out of a hackathon. I think it was the Market Make hackathon by ETH Global in like January of 2021. And we started out really on the smart contract coverage side, and that was because Avert and I had both kind of fallen in love with DeFi as the thing in crypto that we were excited about. NFTs weren't really too crazy back in 2020 yet, and some of the other stuff wasn't around. So we got really excited about DeFi. I come from a financial background. I used to travel around the US trying to figure out how bank stocks were going to do on their quarter. I worked at Citadel trying to do like long short equity trading essentially. And it wasn't the most interesting sector to be in, but it taught me a ton about the traditional financial system, and all the problems with it and all the things that could be better, all the reasons it's kind of hamstrung. So yeah, that was kind of the early intro to the financial system, and then seeing DeFi, it was like a breath of fresh air. It's like, oh my gosh, this is so clearly going to be the future. And if we can get one country to use this financial system, it's just going to be the most awesome thing ever. And so Sherlock was really started because we were trying to figure out like, how do we make sure that DeFi becomes a thing? How do we make sure that DeFi can actually be used by 100 million or 1 billion people? And one of the biggest areas that we didn't see a lot of great efforts in was the security space, really, or at least we didn't trust a lot of the efforts we were seeing around there. And we thought, okay, there probably needs to be more smart contract coverage because you can never prove 100% that any smart contract is safe. I don't care if it's Uniswap V1, there could still be some bug in there that we don't know about, and it causes everybody to get wrecked. And so you do need some kind of like backstop or something that helps users feel comfortable putting their life savings into crypto. And so Sherlock started out on the smart contract coverage side. Avert had been building smart contracts since 2018. He built the smart contracts in the hackathon. I built the front end, in React. It wasn't the greatest thing ever. But yeah, that was kind of how it started out. We went through Kernel through Gitcoin, and got some investors after that. We went through Alliance early on, and that helped us kind of kickstart things and get it going. And we've been doing that ever since. And yeah, that was the smart contract coverage piece. And then on the auditing piece, we got into that a little bit later because we didn't love the experiences that a lot of our coverage customers were having on the auditing side, and it also caused problems for us on the coverage side if the premiums have to be higher because all these hacks are happening and people are paying out bug bounties left and right. So we can talk about that a little bit later maybe, but that's kind of how we got into the auditing side of it as well.
Yeah, cool. I want to hear more about all of the problems that you saw with TradFi that kind of brought you into DeFi in the first place. Like, what are the things that you really saw that DeFi would make so much better?
Yeah, so that was crazy. They would literally, Citadel would send me around first class to go talk to bank CEOs and CFOs, like some of the biggest banks that you've never heard of, like BB&T and KeyBank and all these banks that are really huge, and they're like a big part of the stock market. But no one's ever heard of them because they only exist in like the Ohio region, or they only exist in the South. So I would talk to these guys, and you would just, it was a totally different world, honestly, especially some of the ones in like Texas and the South and these places. Like they would eat just these crazy like full course meals and buffets and these things where you're like, is this real? Like, what's happening? They would have these meetings in these giant country clubs, And of course, nobody knew anything about technology, and it wasn't even something that people cared about except for talking to their investors to make it sound like they had new initiatives coming up. And you know, the people that they were about to promote in the CFO role, the people that that were about to be the next CEOs who were kind of trying to grind to work their way up these corporate ladders, they had no idea about tech either. And it was kind of this thing where no one was allowed to do anything crazy, which made it really hard to make money as a hedge fund, because no one is allowed to make more money than the next bank, and no one is allowed to make less money than the next bank, because they're all kind of in straitjackets in a sense. And so, you know, the things you realize are, wow, no one can do anything interesting, let alone innovative or technologically forward. And then, you know, no one even wants to, because it's just not in the culture of the banks, and it's not something that they're incentivized to do, and not allowed to do, you know, as well. So that was kind of the, it wasn't so much a specific thing of like, hey, they're doing this wrong and DeFi can do it better. It was everything. It's like, whoa, they can't even do the first new cool, like they can barely get their mobile app up and running, and there's regulations around what they have to do there and all these different things. And so, you know, I was looking at that and I was like, man, how would I fix this system? And the answer was, you can't. Like, you would have to, you know, pass a bunch of laws or deregulate and do these different things. Which did happen, you know, a little bit after I was, actually it happened while I was there. They deregulated a little bit, but it didn't make much of a difference. And so when I saw DeFi, I was like, oh, of course, like you have to step completely outside of the system to be able to do the things that, the thousand things that make sense to do. And so that's kind of, that was kind of my introduction to it all, was these guys can't do anything. And there's like a million reasons of, you know, a million miles of red tape. So the only way to have a chance at innovating in that system is really just going outside of it and hoping that you can make a big impact. Kind of like, I mean, Uber and other tech companies have done this example, but you know, this one is kind of like on a worldwide scale immediately. So it's even crazier, I think.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It's just such a ossified kind of industry that you really have to like step outwards if you want to really try to build something new. And since Sherlock started, quite a lot happened. So what was the original plan for Sherlock? What was the main goal and the main business plan?
Yep. So original plan for Sherlock was, smart contracts can only get to 99% safety. They can only get to 100% safety. DeFi is supposed to be a financial system. So people at some point, average people need to feel comfortable putting their life savings into it. And if you can never have 100% safety of smart contracts, then that means people's life savings are always at risk. That's a huge problem for a financial system. That's like the last thing. That's like issue number one, is make sure my money is still there. And so that's why Sherlock got into the smart contract coverage side of things first, you know, more in the realm of Nexus Mutual. And I think there was one called Cover Protocol back in the day, where we were basically just trying to say, okay, there's going to be some kind of market here where someone will take that last 1% of risk in all of these DeFi apps. And if it comes true and one of those hacks happens, you know, there will be sophisticated financial parties that have made these small bets across hundreds of DeFi apps. And so they're expecting to take, you know, a big loss here and there, and they make premiums on the other, you know, hundreds of DeFi apps. And in that way, you move it from this single person lost their entire life savings to this sophisticated financial party lost, you know, 10% of their stake, but they made 15% in premiums that year. So they're totally fine and everybody's fine with it. And so that was the original, and still is what Sherlock does today, actually. But when we brought on our earliest customers to try to do this with them, we quickly realized like, oh, okay, the auditing side of things is not figured out in any way at all. And the auditors that they're working with, they don't actually care. Like, they don't follow up with them. They don't make sure that they, whatever commit they're putting on mainnet is the one that they audited, is the one that's going to be safe. Like, it was a very siloed kind of interaction with auditors. And auditors were honestly not doing that great of a job. So our early customers were paying out big bug bounties. You know, there weren't hacks immediately, but there were bug bounties being paid out. Sherlock used some of the top auditors in the space for our protocol. We paid out massive bug bounties like 2 weeks after an audit. And we're just standing there like, this is completely broken. Like, whatever's happening here, it cannot continue happening, because the coverage thing we're building is never going to work. Everything else, people, you know, trying to put smart contracts safely onto the blockchain, that's not going to work. And so, you know, it was kind of a long process where we tried to say, okay, let's try to use just the best auditors. Let's try to enforce that every protocol that comes to us obviously has to be audited. And then eventually, probably like a year into Sherlock, we started doing our own kind of putting people together. So we would have, you know, Chris Michel, Gerard Persson, put them together, put another guy on there. And, you know, basically we did that model for a while. And then we kind of realized, okay, there are fundamental limitations to that model. And so, you know, a year and a half into Sherlock, we finally said, okay, we think we know what the best audit model would look like. We can't trust that anyone else in the space is actually going to build that model and do it. So we're just going to go ahead and build it ourselves. And then that will be part of, you know, what makes our smart contract coverage even more powerful, is we have these cool like audits that allow us to charge the lowest premiums on the smart contract coverage side. So that was probably kind of an answer that went in a bunch of different areas, but we started out in smart contract coverage. We got into auditing later because we wanted to make the smart contract coverage more affordable, honestly.
And do you do a coverage for everyone that goes through the Sherlock audit, or is it an optional thing?
Yeah, it's an optional thing. We didn't want to force it on people because that's a little bit of a newer, it's a more nascent part of the industry, I would say. It's you know, experienced some challenges in the last year and a half because it requires LPs to be very active. And I mean, I've probably got an Excel list of 100 LPs that I used to talk to that, you know, had, you know, either put money in or were about to put money into the Sherlock protocol in order to help people, you know, get paid back and have this pool of capital. I would say probably 70 or 80 of those LPs are either totally dead or incapacitated or have gotten out of the space in such a big way that they really don't do anything in the space anymore. And the other ones are also just being super conservative because, as you know, it was like Luna Terra UST blow up, then it was Celsius and BlockFi, then it was the next thing, then it was, you know, Maple, then it was FTX. And it was almost impossible for any LP to emerge from that completely unscathed. I mean, they thought they were getting into stable coins with UST and they were going to be safe there. Like, they thought they were going into like a reputable kind of TradFi stuff with some of these other providers, and those blew up too. So that's made the smart contract coverage side of it more challenging. And so, you know, that's been a little bit more on the back burner as LPs are kind of licking their wounds and trying to, you know, eventually get back into the space, hopefully. But we're still excited about it.
So then it went from mainly being about the coverage and turned more into being towards the audits being the main focus after this whole cleansing of business going down.
Yeah, I think you know, we still do the coverage. We're still writing coverage for a bunch of protocols and helping them. You know, we're in a lot of different, I guess, war rooms sometimes. We're in a lot of different bug bounty programs trying to help people figure out if different bugs are real or not based on audits we did. So we're like super actively involved in post audit processes and trying to make sure that the protocols that we audited that have the coverage are able to kind of, you know, hopefully not pay out or pay out when they should and prevent an exploit from happening. And to kind of follow up on your earlier question, we don't make every single person we audit get the coverage, again, because it's more of a niche product right now, and it's not something that's as required in the space as audits. I mean, hopefully it will be one day, because I think it was really like the 2017 ICO boom that kind of was so disastrous in some ways, where people said, okay, everyone needs to get an audit. Like, and the whole space kind of just agreed on that, or at least the investors kind of said, we're done with any project that's not getting an audit. So that became like part of the requirements almost, which is great. Like, that's called self-regulation in a lot of ways when an industry comes together and demands something like that. And, you know, hopefully the smart contract coverage side will also be that someday, but it's on the providers like Sherlock to make sure the premiums are low enough to make it affordable. And it's on, you know, investors and users to make sure that they demand that kind of thing from projects they use. So it's a little bit further down the line.
Yeah, you mentioned that you guys are in a lot of war rooms. And I think that's a part that often gets overlooked until it's too late, especially by newer projects that don't have the kind of battle scars or have seen enough things happen to think about that kind of stuff. So what kind of advice would you give for projects that are coming right now or like trying to set up things correctly? What would you say would be good practice in that realm?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on a lot of things. It depends on kind of how you've set up your smart contracts. Are they upgradable? Are they not upgradable, but there are still things that you can do to mitigate losses or mitigate exploits when they happen or as they're ongoing. So that's a big area where if it is upgradable or if there is something you can do, then you want to really be flexible when it comes to, hey, something bad happened and we need to execute a transaction with our multi-sig or whatever it is, our DAO has to go through a vote. That is probably the most important process, is how do we figure out how to mitigate the problem, which Sherlock can often be helpful with, or the security experts that we bring in can often be helpful with. But the protocol team needs to be, you know, like, everyone is remote. You're in Australia. Some people are in Europe. Like, everyone being awake at the same time in the multi-sig is not a given. And so just being able to have a plan where it's like, okay, at any given hour, there's going to be enough people around, or we can wake enough people up, like they have a special phone or special notification on their phone or whatever it is to wake up and do an emergency action. That can be really powerful. But there are also protocols like Ajna, which I think are amazing, where there's no ability to do that. They have no admin powers. They have no multi-sig that can upgrade anything. And so that brings in totally different challenges when it comes to a exploit situation, a war room situation, where if they had an exploit, there's not a ton they could do except try to get the word out to their users to have the users take actions. And then that's a whole nother thing of like, okay, well, how do you make sure your users know which actions to take to you know, mitigate their exposure and that kind of thing. So the biggest one is just being able to take very quick action. And then when it comes to other pieces, like maybe finding the hacker and figuring out if this is someone you know who was in your team or if it's someone else. You know, I think Sherlock has been pretty helpful with that in the past. We know a lot of the people who can help with that. And there's other initiatives SEAL, what is it called? SEAL 911,
which I think... 911, yeah.
Yeah, which can be, you know, absolutely critical to bring in as early as you can to a lot of those situations.
Yeah, cool. And obviously, Sherlock started seeing the success in audit contests and decided to implement your own version, as you saw, like that had the best cost benefit ratio. So what sets Sherlock apart from the other contest platforms?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, candidly, when we were running the smart contract coverage and we were doing kind of the matching one auditor with another and putting together these small teams and having them do audits, we kind of realized, okay, there's some limitations here. And, you know, we saw Code Arena, Sherlock had used Code Arena twice. And we were like, wow, this is a super powerful model. Like, you just get so many more eyes on the code. You get so much more, just like raw horsepower, looking for vulnerabilities in your code base in a super incentivized way. As a reminder, traditional audits, there isn't a super strong incentive for individuals to try their hardest. And that's something that should never, incentives should never be overlooked, in my opinion, in any area of life. And yes, traditional audit firms, auditors, they have reputation, they have things that they want that makes them want to find the most vulnerabilities possible. Intellectually, it's interesting, all these things. But at the end of the day, a competitive model is just, it brings an entire new aspect to trying to find as many bugs possible. And, maybe there's 3 hours left in the audit, and most people might say, hey, yeah, that was great. We found a lot of bugs. But when it's a competition, you're like, man, let me make the most of those 3 hours. Let me look for that, 10th bug. Let me look for that 13th bug. So the contest model just had way more horsepower. And obviously, Scott Lewis and Zach Cole came up with a really, really awesome kind of a structure there that made it kind of workable. And Sherlock went through that process twice. It was really great, but there were some. The horsepower, the raw horsepower was really good, but it was not kind of whittled down to the core product that we think it could have been in terms of, my co-founder Averett was having to look through 700 submissions even a year and a half, 2 years ago when we were going through these contests. And we were like, man, he's like spending a week and a half doing this. This is kind of crazy. He's also not sure if he's going to miss something or not. And if he misses something, like, that could be a critical vulnerability, and that could cause massive problems for, for the protocol. And so, Sherlock kind of faced a decision where we were like, okay, we like a lot of the aspects of traditional audits. We like a lot of aspects of what Code Arena is doing because they were the only audit contest provider at that time. Do we go with one of those, or do we make our own thing? And ultimately, we didn't feel comfortable going with either of those two routes. And so we kind of said, okay, let's make our own thing that combines those two. And so I think of Sherlock less as a contest model that really competes directly with Code Arena, and more of like, here's a hybrid between traditional audits and contest audits. And hopefully it brings in some extra synergies where the traditional guys now have to, they're now incentivized to find as many things as they can because their ranking is on the line. They get paid more for doing it. And so, it brings, we like a lot about traditional audits, the fixed review, the being able to talk to a real person who, is super familiar and dedicated to your code base. And so we really wanted to bring in kind of the best of both worlds is what we call it. We wanted to bring in the best of both traditional audits and audit contests. And so that's why we put together this thing that we felt would give us the best chance of charging the lowest premiums on the smart contract coverage side of things. That's what it was all about. It was like, how do we make sure that we can make the coverage side of things workable and have the least amount of exploits and bug bounty payouts? And so that's how we got to that model.
Yeah, that makes sense. And there's quite a few different things going on in Sherlock than at least what originally was Code Arena. That is not only that you have someone that's like hired for the audit, you also have the competition model, but you also have a different judging criteria. So what is the reason behind, maybe you can outline the difference in judging criteria and also explain why I decided to go in that route.
Yeah, we can definitely talk about that. I think there's a lot of different ways to do judging well. And I guess to zoom out even a little bit more, judging is a really, really difficult problem. If you want to make sure that every single submission, and let's assume there's 1,000 submissions in an audit contest, if you want to make sure that every single submission is perfectly understood and reviewed, to the max where you're not missing anything, you're perfectly understanding it, you know that it's valid and that it's high severity or whatever it is. You basically need someone who is a very strong security expert, someone who's very strong in smart contract security. You need them to also have really deep context on that code base. So they have to have spent hours and hours understanding that code base and the exact context of every single bug. And you need them to be completely unbiased. So basically, if they're competing in the contest, then they're going to be biased. You know, if their friend is competing in the contest, they might be biased. Like there's all these different things where you have to deal with that as well. So because you have to have those three things, even the bias alone is almost impossible to prove, right? That a certain judge doesn't bias one participant over the other. So you're starting out with basically an impossible set of requirements in terms of doing judging really well. And then from there, it's like, okay, well, how do we kind of maximize, you know, those different areas as much as we can so that we get the best judging experience possible, and we find the most exploits and show them to the protocol team and tell them that they're important and those sort of things. You know, I'm not actually super familiar with how Code Arena does judging. I know that you have to be kind of backstage and I think KYC'd, and you have to have done a certain number of things in order to participate. And so I don't actually have a ton of context on the details of it, so I can't even speak to it. But my understanding is that, you know, they have kind of one person that is mostly in charge of the judging. And for Sherlock, I guess the way to describe the difference would be that there's a judging contest that is attempting to be civil resistant and bring in, you know, as many participants as possible, and kind of come to consensus agreements between participants who are maybe a little bit biased on certain issues, but as a whole, you know, they're less unbiased. I guess a good example that people might be familiar with is Twitter's community notes, or X's community notes, where you have these people, but you can kind of work around their biases and you can kind of get them all to agree on something. And so the decentralized judging system that Sherlock has created is really trying to do that in sort of an algorithmic way, and then get to the right set of judgments at the end of that. And then, of course, we have the lead judge who is able to kind of figure out where things went wrong, figure out kind of you know, okay, these guys all judged it this way, I judged it that way, I think they're actually right, I'm going to change my judgment. They're incentivized to do that. We can go through the exact, there's a lot of pieces to Sherlock's kind of judging process. So we can go through all of those pieces. But the biggest difference, I would say, is that Sherlock's is very decentralized. Anyone can participate in it. And it's trying to take the wisdom of the crowd into account using an algorithm that hopefully, you know, takes out the worst part of the crowd and leaves in the highest signal pieces.
Wouldn't that be even more work to the leading judge because they not only have to do the judging themselves, but then they also have to sift through all these other people that are judging, which takes even more of his time considering that there can be like thousands of issues. And if he's already judging it in the first place, wouldn't it be just more efficient and sometimes even fairer so everyone gets equal treatment to just use him as the main source of truth? Because it might be that a lot of these judging participants are coordinating into judging something that wasn't really true. So we could make an argument that it could be counterproductive. So how does that actually makes it more effective, this decentralization approach?
Yeah, great question. So, you know, the first question, is it more work for the lead judge? I think it is actually more work if you compare it to just the lead judge doing their own thing with the same number of issues. Obviously, if you compare it to Code Arena, I think it's a lot less work just because the number of issues submitted on Sherlock tends to be only high. It is only high medium issues, and so it tends to be kind of a lower number of issues, which means less work. But in terms of the decentralized process creating more work for the lead judge, I think it's potentially true because they have to go through every single issue themselves as part of the contest, and then they're given basically a aggregation of everyone else's results. And you know, they can kind of see, okay, this is what all these people thought, do I agree with that or not? And this isn't super well known, but they're actually incentivized to change their opinion if they think they're wrong. So it's more like a, hey, here's the answers to the test that the rest of the class came up with, you can look at that and try to decide if your answers, you still like your answers or not. And they're incentivized to change their answer because if it gets to escalations and then it gets overturned in escalations, they get penalized more than if they change it after the judging contest. They don't get penalized if they change it after the judging contest, but it will hurt their judging contest results, you know, if they are basically judging their own things as incorrect, but it will hurt them more if they wait till the escalation period. So it's kind of like you took a test, you think you got like a 90% on it, hopefully, and you're going to pass the class, but people, you know, you get this, you get like the answers of the rest of the class, and you get to say like, hey, okay, well, that's interesting. 20 people disagreed with me on this issue. And by the way, they wrote a bunch of comments about why they chose that. And I actually kind of agree with what they said. So I'm going to go ahead and change my answer. And I'm incentivized to do that because I'll save myself from getting penalized in the escalation period if I do it now and change it now instead of having it get overturned later. So it is a little bit more work for the lead judge, but I think it ends up being beneficial to the overall accuracy of the judging recall.
Don't you think it opens a avenue for people coming together, let's say a group of people that are judging the contest and submitting opinions in a coordinated way to try and sway the judge into something that isn't factually true, but because he's seen that repeatedly from many different people, like reading slightly different ways, he might actually be convinced, and that might deter him from getting to the truth, and that wouldn't be possible if there wasn't that option. Is that something that you guys have in mind and have encountered, or have something to prevent?
Yeah, I mean, that's always a risk. And I think, you know, a funny kind of example in that vein is, I think Sam Altman tweeted like a week ago and said, hey, I think artificial intelligence is going to be like maximum stats on persuasiveness first, and then it will get to maximum stats on like accuracy and truth later. And I think that's kind of, I mean, people do submit ChatGPT stuff or GPT-4 stuff in audit contests. Like, I think that's pretty well known and something that needs to be combated. But, you know, that's like the ultimate boss of what you just said is, okay, if you have something that's like maximum stats on persuasiveness, how do you make sure that the lead judge doesn't, you know, take the truth and change it to something that's false because they're persuaded to do that? And I don't think there's a great answer there, except that the lead judge needs to, you know, take in all the evidence into account and try to stay close to the code, stay close to the facts of the situation, and hopefully get it right. And if they don't get it right, then the Sherlock judge will have to do that same process where they have to stay close to the code, they have to listen to the arguments and try to take the, you know, extract the truth, extract the signal from those arguments and ignore the persuasive noise around them. And I think that's a challenge in any situation, in any setup.
Yeah, that makes sense. And another scenario that I don't know how you guys handle, that let's say I'm judging it and I'm just doing it on my spare time. Sorry. And then I get to, I don't know, issue 20 and I'm like, oh, I'm sick of this, don't want to do this anymore. And I just make the, let's say it has like very little issues, it only has 40 issues in the whole thing, and the bottom 20 are like, I'm just gonna mark them all as valid. How could that possibly affect the judge's mind, and how do you guys approach this sort of thing as well?
Yeah, that's a great question. So that's something that we thought a lot about when we were deciding how to set up kind of the judging algorithm. And I don't know how familiar you are with it, but there's kind of three thresholds that every judge has to clear in order to get any kind of reward. And then there's six, I guess, partial credit or six criteria that determine how much reward you get. So there's like three thresholds that determine, did you pass the three thresholds, you're eligible for any amount of reward. And then you have these six criteria that determine, okay, how much reward do you get if you pass those three thresholds. And the entire a lot of the point of those nine semi-complicated, they're not too complicated, but it takes a little bit of a little while to understand them. A lot of the reason for those is dealing with those situations you said, where, okay, what if somebody submits everything is valid in the repo? What if somebody submits everything is invalid? It's a much different problem than an audit contest because people have to come up with stuff out of nothing. In the judging contest, it's a multiple choice test. And so it's much harder to prevent civil because you have to basically try to figure out, okay, what is statistically significant and what isn't? And so what if someone submits all false issues? What if someone submits all valid, everything is valid? What if somebody submits a random assortment? So they just randomize it and then they send a bunch of randomized ones. Like, how do you deal with that? Like you said, what if they spend half of their time or a quarter of their time doing it correctly and then they submit everything valid from there? So it's a really difficult problem. But I think from what we've seen, those thresholds and criteria do a really good job of making sure, like, if you try hard on half of it, and then you submit valid for the other half, you're probably going to trip one of those thresholds. Like you're probably going to miss something. And that's going to cause you to not get a reward in that judging contest. And then that will hopefully incentivize people to behave differently. The lead judges will be the ones who are doing the best in these contests. And so hopefully the right behaviors will kind of come out of the natural selection process of people learning the rules and abiding by them in the best way possible, hopefully.
So is the lead judge the main source of truth? So he ultimately decides which things have been correct or not.
So the Sherlock judge is actually the main source of truth at the very end. They're the ones who are able to see what the lead judge said. They're able to see what the lead senior Watson thinks. They're able to see the rest of the judging contest results. And they will normally just be looking at the specific details of the issue, and they're looking across a much smaller, they're looking across a subset of issues, which is like hopefully there's only 20 escalations out of 200 issues submitted, or even less, honestly. But they will be able to spend more time and hopefully are the most unbiased participant in the entire process. And so they have the final say.
And so the Sherlock judge would be responsible for all the contests going on in Sherlock, or each contest has like a different judge.
Yeah, that's a great question. That's something that we're actively rethinking right now in terms of it used to be just one judge or one Sherlock judge who was responsible for everything. And if there was one contest going on, then they didn't have that much to do. If there's 20 contests going on, then they have way more than they can handle. And so, that's something that we're actively thinking about in terms of the best way to approach it. Right now, while contest volume isn't insane, there aren't, 20 contests happening in 1 week. You can basically get away with a lot of things that you won't be able to get away with if the volume is much higher.
Yeah, I imagine that even if you only had like five contests ongoing and each of those had 10 escalations, that already for one person alone, it's way too much because then you're getting the nitty-gritties of the context, the code bases you really need to understand, and to holding your brain five code bases in any meaningful way, from my perspective, is just really unrealistic. So if you're thinking about having 10, 20 contests simultaneously, I think that's definitely not the approach you want to go towards for sure. And something that's also very different from Sherlock is that you guys only count high and medium findings. So can you dive into a little bit of why that is and why did you guys make that choice?
And I guess to talk about that first part of, keeping five different code bases in your head as kind of that final person, I agree with that and I slightly disagree with it. I think, I've been the Sherlock judge for some contests and I've, been through that process of resolving every single escalation and getting to the bottom of it. And for a lot of the escalations, you know, it can be resolved just by being a referee between two people and kind of just having a conversation go, okay, this is the person who thinks this is valid, this is the person who thinks it's invalid, and now I'm just going to hear their arguments out, kind of like a judge, you know, or like a referee or something, a moderator. And you can get really, really far doing that. And that means you don't have to spend hours getting up to speed on the exact intricate details of every contract in a code base. You know, you can figure out, okay, there were 20 escalations. There's four of them where the back and forth conversation is still, you know, it's something where they haven't resolved it on their own, and now I have to go dig into it. And then you can kind of do a much more surgical dive on, okay, this is this issue. These are the assumptions around this code base and what these, you know, people are saying in terms of why it's valid and invalid. And I think you can get pretty accurate judgments without having to spend hours getting up to speed on the code base. But you know, caveat, getting judging to 100% accuracy, like I said at the beginning, is super difficult, and it requires like you to max out different areas that are super expensive to do, super time consuming to do. There's only a very small subset of people who can even be in that category. You can never prove that someone's totally unbiased. So, you know, there's always going to be, it's never going to be 100% perfect in my view on the judging side. And then on the high and medium severity only. So again, that's really an output of Sherlock trying to maximize the smart contract coverage side of things and make sure that exploits are as rare as possible, bug bounty payouts are as rare as possible. And for us, you know, we had just seen a lot of people spending a lot of time doing things that were not the highest and best use of their time, if that makes sense. So going through a code base, finding all of the comments in the code base where the comment doesn't exactly match, you know, the implementation of the code, because, you know, every dev isn't perfect, and there's different times where you change your mind on stuff. And even if it's very clear that they changed how the code base works in general or whatever, they forgot to update a comment. Going through doing that stuff, you know, documentation, low severity things, it really has a material impact on the amount of time that people can spend looking at a single code base. Like auditing is a time boxed effort, and so time is like your most important, the most valuable thing you have, at least as a protocol team, getting auditor time. It's like very, very, you want to maximize it as much as possible. And so, you know, as an organization that has put two code bases on mainnet and has worked with these customers to try to understand, okay, what kind of bug bounties are you paying out? What do the exploits look like? Like, what are you most worried about? How do you recover from different situations? You know, if you deploy some contracts and there was actually a bug in the deployment script or whatever, and you spent 3K of ETH to deploy it, but now you have to redeploy, it's like, yeah, that's bad. And maybe you blame your auditor for not helping you with the deployment script, or if there's some bug that they didn't understand in the code base that caused the deployment to go wrong. It's like, yeah, you can blame the auditor for that, and you can write a Twitter thread about them, and you know, it will cost you $3,000, which is on top of what you already paid for the audit. But at the end of the day, you're going to continue just fine as a protocol team. After that kind of situation, life is going to go on. You're going to be there the next day. Like, you didn't lose your runway at all. Like, you didn't cause any users to lose funds. And so Sherlock is just really trying to be pragmatic about it and say, what are the things that you're actually going to care about that are going to cause your project to fail, that are going to cause your users to hate you, or lose money, or go and use your competitor instead? And in our view, those are the really bad things. Those are the hacks that take a lot of the TVL out of the contracts. Those are the hacks that cause, you know, material percentage losses for the users, or freeze the contracts forever. These things that cause an extremely degraded experience for users. And so Sherlock, I think it's great to point out low severity vulnerabilities. I think it's great to point out areas where the comments don't match the code, or the documentation could be better, and all of these different areas. Gas optimizations are really great as well. I love all of that stuff. But unfortunately, there's trade-offs to spending time on it. And Sherlock is really trying to be the final exam before mainnet. Like, we want to be the audit where you go to us because you know this is the final test and all of the most critical vulnerabilities that could be on mainnet are supposed to get kind of flushed out here. And so because Sherlock is trying to do that, and we're trying to do that because of the smart contract coverage, because we care, we're incentivized to care about people not paying out big bug bounties, big exploits on mainnet. We had to cut scope and say, time is our most valuable asset. We want to make sure every single auditor is spending all of their time finding the most critical things.
Want to touch on a bunch of different things now. So I guess I'll just touch on something that you said before about the transparency of the judging issues. And have you guys considered doing it in a way that you can hide the names from the people submitting the issues so you diminish the bias?
Yep, that's a great question. So we've actually already done that. Every judging contest participant, their names are hidden when the, let me think about it. So their names show up again in the escalations because people have to come in and they have to comment on things. And so eventually it's kind of a limitation of GitHub, to be honest, that we would need to basically like obscure everybody's handle from being able to comment on the issues in GitHub. But in the initial phase, everybody's issues are or everybody's name is obscured, and so they're given a pseudonym so that there isn't any initial bias, at least in looking at, okay, these are the issues from the lead senior Watson, and so we're going to make sure that we mark all these as valid and everyone else's are invalid, whatever people think is going on. We have obscured everyone's name post judging contest so that the protocol team can't see it, the lead judge cannot see it initially. And so that I think has, if there was bias happening, which it's hard to know exactly how much was going on, I think it's a human nature to take the, lead senior Watson's issues and hold them in a little bit higher regard. I think it actually makes sense to do that in most cases, but that is technically a bias. And so we have tried to eliminate that, and I think that problem's gotten a lot better from the feedback that we've gotten from some of the people who were, not thrilled about the names not being obscured in the first place.
It can be a bit of a tricky one if you, because obviously the people that already have a name for themselves should have the right to have more weight in this question because they are allegedly proven. But at the same time, it makes it unfair because you can be a upcomer that is doing really well and have a good point nonetheless. And regarding to the lows and high, to the lows and gas optimizations that are not incentivizing Sherlock, would you then say that Sherlock should really be viewed as the last audit that you go before deploying to mainnet, and is not really meant to be the first or second or maybe even third pass, and it's something that you really only do right before you go to mainnet, for example?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think Sherlock is able to be everything to everyone, and I think the, services provided by, I would say, traditional auditors, I mean, that's kind of the bulk of auditors in the space still. The services provided by traditional auditors are just really, really valuable for that kind of early to mid stage where you are not only trying to find the vulnerabilities, but also figure out what are the areas that are causing the vulnerabilities? What are things that are just assumptions that, break because of the nature of Solidity or because of the nature of smart contract security? And I think, having a traditional audit ahead of time, having somebody kind of be hold your hand a little bit more in terms of talking to the protocol team on the phone a lot, telling them, hey, why did you do this? Like, oh, there's another way to do this better if you want to do this now. Early enough stage to where they're still able to make a lot of material changes to their code base that will make their security better, not only for later audits, but for later versions as well, later upgrades that they might make to that code base. So yeah, I think those audits are super valuable, and Sherlock doesn't try to do that better than anyone else. I think Sherlock is actually disadvantaged in being the very first audit you have, because it's harder to kind of, you know, get the lead senior Watson on the phone during the contest and ask them about what they've found and different aspects in that vein. So Sherlock is really just laser focused on how do we give you that best final exam audit so that you're going to go to mainnet after this, and we want to minimize the chance that there's any kind of critical bug, loss of funds bug, freezing bug, you know, anything that can cause a materially degraded experience to your users. Sherlock is all about finding that, and we're not going to be able to hold your hand as much in terms of getting on calls. We're not going to be able to, you know, you're probably not looking to change your code base as much at that point in terms of the architecture for future upgrades. You're not really supposed to be looking for gas optimizations at that point, because gas optimizations can cause security issues in their own right, as we've seen. And so, yeah, that's kind of where Sherlock is laser focused, because we care so much about making sure that, you know, we don't pay out bug bounties, we don't pay out exploits on mainnet.
Yeah, that makes sense. So at what point would you say a project is ready to go to a Sherlock audit?
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's something that we need to be doing a lot more work around, because there are definitely times where protocols come to Sherlock too early, if that makes sense. And it results in a degraded experience for everyone, because the protocol team has a bad experience. I mean, they get a ton of bugs, which might be, I mean, that's not fun in its own right. But they paid a lot of money for a Sherlock audit contest. You know, Sherlock audits are not cheap. They're trying to be that final thing where everything gets found. And you probably could have saved yourself a lot of money by working with a traditional auditor or working with a solo auditor ahead of a Sherlock contest. And, you know, gotten 80% of the bugs out that way. And it would have costed, you know, well, traditional auditors, maybe not, but with a solo auditor, I think it would have costed significantly less. And so that would just be a better experience for the protocol team. And then if a protocol team shows up to Sherlock too early, it's a bad experience for the judges, who now have to judge like thousands of duplicate issues or whatever it is, because there are some, you know, fairly obvious issues that are found in the code base. And a lot of security experts are very talented these days, and so a lot of them are going to find it. And then it also results in, you know, problems for Sherlock itself, because we have to operationally deal with all of these issues and get it all through the pipeline and feel good about, okay, what if the protocol does go to mainnet right after this? There's 20 critical vulnerabilities. Where's the 21st one? Or how do we make sure that that 20th one is not getting lost in judging somewhere because there's 1,000 issues? So, yeah, I actually don't have the best answer to how to make sure that protocols don't show up to Sherlock too early. We try to put in some, you know, barriers in terms of having your test suite totally done, you know, having your code commenting in a good place with NatSpec commenting, doing things that at least signal that you're a more mature code base, and just doing a test suite alone, you can find a lot of bugs that we've audited protocols where the test suite would have 100% caught, you know, a bug. And because the test suite wasn't fully done, the bug was still there. So we try to do some things and try to encourage protocols to not use Sherlock until they're fully ready. But, you know, it's hard to know when they're fully ready. Like, okay, you've got one solo audit, they found 5 criticals. Does that mean you're ready? You did one traditional audit beforehand. Does that mean you're ready? It's always difficult to know.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's really important to address, because if they're not ready, it's also a big waste of time for the auditors themselves, because they're not going to be able to go down to the deepest bugs as well, because they're going to be busy with the low-hanging fruits. And in my opinion, it probably, you know, after a few rounds of having maybe one or two highs maximum that have easy fixes, then it's something that you can probably start thinking about, from my standpoint. But of course, it varies from protocol to protocol, and of course, it depends who are doing those audits. You know, if you get an audit from certain companies, one or two highs don't mean much. So if you're strategic with who's providing the services to you, and then you're really performing well under those audits, then that's something. Then Sherlock could be something that could be for you as the next step in your security stack.
And it's like I said, this was one of the biggest problems that Sherlock faced with the coverage early on was how do we know which auditors are good? Like, how do we know that, a certain audit firm is going to make sure that minimize the chance of critical bugs being there on mainnet? And, we had terrible experiences with some traditional auditors, honestly, which is why we're in auditing now. We didn't want to be in auditing, necessarily, but we decided we had to do it because we had such bad experiences with some of the traditional audits, where we paid out, not bad as in like I didn't like the guy or something, but bad as in we paid out six-figure bug bounties within 2 weeks of the audit finishing, kind of thing, where you're just like, wow, okay, someone else out there was clearly looking at this code base harder than these auditors were, probably at the same time. So it's a tricky situation there. And then in terms of the Watsons themselves, it's a really interesting situation because they don't want to audit a code base that has a million bugs in it, like you said, because then you're just writing reports all day and you don't even make it through the whole code base in the allotted time because there's so many bugs that you have to write up that it's just like exhausting and not fun. And you're like, everyone is going to duplicate these because they're so obvious. So that extreme is bad. But then they also don't like the other extreme where there's zero bugs. And it's like, okay, it's clear that this code base is just so bulletproof that there's going to be no higher medium issues in it. That's an extremely rare thing. I don't think that's ever really happened, at least for an upcoming Sherlock audit. But you have to, security experts don't like that side either because that means that no one will be able to differentiate from others in the contest if there's no bugs. So kind of being in that middle is the sweet spot.
I think the bit that there's no vulnerabilities, it's really something that shouldn't be worried about, and it's gonna be once in a blue moon event. So I don't think you guys have to do much worrying about that one. I think. But have you guys
Hopefully in 10 or
considered?
20 years in crypto, we'll worry about that all the time. But for now, it's unfortunately not something that comes up much.
That's gonna be a good problem for the ecosystem to have, I believe. Have you guys
Definitely.
considered having like an internal database with previous audits and the amount of bugs that have been found in Sherlock? Is that something you guys already do to kind of have a sense of who's ready, who's not for the Sherlock audit for your own reference?
Oh, interesting. So a database of other audits that have occurred or Sherlock audits?
Other audits that have occurred before the Sherlock audit. So let's say firm XYZ audited this protocol last, and then after the Sherlock audit, we found like X amount of bugs. And then you can build a database and see which firms usually present better prepared clients for the Sherlock audits. And then you can kind of advise protocols in a better way.
Yeah, that's really interesting. That's really interesting. And I think the audit space is finally getting to the point where we need to start doing that kind of thing. And I mean, you can never, right now, no one quantitatively knows which auditors are better unless they're auditing the same commit and they're given, the same like time to audit it, unless you're putting them exactly head to head. Or they're competing in an audit contest, it's very difficult to know, okay, audit firm one audited this code base in January, audit firm two audited this code base afterwards in June. It's impossible to compare, perfectly which audit firm did better, no matter what the results were, because they could have made changes in between and added some crazy critical vulnerabilities, and so the first auditor didn't even have a chance to catch it. But I think this is an initiative that needs to start happening in crypto because we're still seeing so many audit firms that, in my opinion, if there was a more quantifiable way to show efficacy, these audit firms would not be around. And so I think it's really important that we start finding ways. It's not going to be perfect in terms of like, okay, we know 100% that this audit firm on this audit was better than this other audit firm on this audit, but at least something that is in the ballpark of statistically significant that we can say, hey, this audit firm found one critical across 20 audits. This audit firm found 20 criticals across 20 audits. Like, how can we find a way to normalize that data in a way where we say, okay, it was actually better that that audit firm that found 20, criticals, that was actually better, and that audit firm was more effective. We need to start coming up with ways to do that.
Yeah, I think you can do some sort of data segmentation where, let's say, there's been these three firms that audited this protocol before Sherlock, and in whatever order, and then these other firms audited this other protocol in a different order, and if you have enough data, you can kind of like juggle all these, and try to see the commonalities, and see if the place where the audit firm was in the audit order matter or not, like, and just trying to start to draw relationships between all these data points. I think
Right.
with you guys probably have like hundreds of contests by now. So I imagine you'd be able to gather enough data to have a meaningful opinion. Definitely wouldn't be like 100% correct opinion, but I think with this approach, you definitely can have some really useful deductions.
Yeah, no, I think there's definitely something there. And I would love to try, I guess, before doing the full quantitative analysis across a broad data set, I think it would be useful to do it across like one protocol that got, like six audits, because there are some protocols where they get six audits or something on the same, roughly the same, at least the same version, like on their V2. Obviously, the commits are very different and they make upgrades in between and all these things, but I would love to. I think the first step would be digging into that and just being like, okay, the third audit firm found this bug. Did the first and second miss it? Or was it a bug that was introduced after those two audits? And doing something like that.
Yeah, I think that's a very difficult approach because depending on what layer of the audit stack you're in, you're gonna be looking at different things. So let's say you're the first one, then there might be a bunch of lows, a bunch of gas optimizations, a bunch of mediums, a bunch of other hairy places that you were looking to, and you just didn't have enough time to look at this extra hairy place because a lot of the times you have this feeling of the probability of finding a bug if you go down this type of rabbit hole, right? Certain rabbit holes are more fruitful than others. So most people's instinct, it goes to the one that they find is going to be the most fruitful. But then when you go to the next layer, and because it's time bound, you can't go to all of them. And then when you go to the next layer, the people that would have gone to that most fruitful rabbit hole can't really go there because it's already being fixed, and then you have to dig for the deeper ones. So I think that can get quite tricky comparing things that are not happening parallel but are happening like vertically. But yeah, something can definitely be learned from this for sure.
Yeah, I'm curious about it because if you do it on the whole broad data set, then you don't have any of the context of like, okay, well, this is showing up this way, but like, why is that? And I guess you can dig into it afterwards, but it requires a lot of digging, to really understand exactly why this bug was found at this point versus, why wasn't it found earlier, or why did this person find five bugs in this audit, but they found two bugs. And the other one, and it's like, well, this one was 5 weeks, this one was 3 weeks, and this one was on, 4,000 nSlok, this one was on 1,000 nSlok, or Solidity lines of code. So it's it's a tricky exercise, but someone at some point has got to find a way to make some kind of statistically significant comparison there.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of crunching down the data, get some data scientists and let him go crazy. I think something's definitely going to come out of it. We've been talking about a lot of different things that are involved in Sherlock, and all these moving pieces kind of have to fit together. So what has been the most challenging thing about running auditing contests?
What is the most challenging thing about running audit contests? That's a good question. I think, the easiest part of running an audit contest is announcing you're going to start doing it. And the hardest part is everything else, probably. I think the judging is probably the most difficult. Like, if we're talking about, what it's hard because you also want to focus on things that are the most impactful, like, okay, making sure that we're getting the right talent into every audit is a hard problem, but you don't necessarily know that you're doing it wrong if you're doing it incorrectly, because there's no one to hold you accountable, like, and say, hey, you should have had, this person with this much talent or this aggregation of talent in this audit, and it was clear that you didn't because of these bugs that were found later. Like, there's no way to check that. So, it's hard to say that. Certain problems are not problems, but I think the judging piece is really tricky because, like we were talking about earlier, you can just never be 100%. You can never get to 100% accuracy and be 100% sure that you found everything and you understood every vulnerability properly and you deduplicated it properly. And the stakes are extremely high. Like, if you get 1,000 issues or 3,000 issues, and one critical vulnerability gets duped as some other issue, and then it will get missed because no one will see it. That can result in terrible, terrible outcomes and cause, all of the TVL of that project to be gone on mainnet. So judging is probably the one that keeps you up at night the most in terms of trying to make sure that it's being done correctly.
Yeah, I imagine that is probably by far the most challenging aspect of the audit contest model. But I'm glad that you guys are trying different ways of approaching it. I feel like it's good to have different iterations to try and solve this problem because it's such a non-trivial problem. And eventually, if you mess around with enough configurations to try and solve it, the most optimal one is going to emerge eventually, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. The perfect one may never emerge, but the most optimal one will hopefully emerge soon enough.
And what's the vision for Sherlock in the time being? What's the vision for Sherlock in the short-term future and the long-term future?
It's a great question. I think, it's a really interesting time in crypto where everyone's trying to figure out, like, where the space is going. Are we going to be, in more of a bear market? Are things turning around? Like, I think last week Bitcoin was up 20% or something, 25%. So, it's difficult to try to understand, where the space is going and if Sherlock should be caring more about making sure that, 20 contests a week can be handled, or making sure that Sherlock is doing other things in a bear market that don't have to do with scaling. It's the short term is definitely difficult to figure out. But I think, we're just doubling down on what we're currently doing. We're trying to make sure that that final exam audit is the best one out there, and that Sherlock is delivering that, and pushing aside the things that we don't care about so much in terms of the lows and the gas optimizations and the consulting side of things, and helping protocols with broader architectural things, and just saying, hey, this is what we do. We do it really well, and we also give you that coverage afterwards and help pay for your bug bounty if you pay out bug bounties, that kind of thing. I think Sherlock, wants to live there for a while and just really become good at those things, because there's a lot of improvements that could be made and there's a lot that needs to be done to improve those aspects. And, you know, hopefully the TVLs in the space generally will come back. Hopefully the amount of coverage Sherlock can write will increase as our TVL grows again. And then that will become an even more meaningful reason to work with Sherlock and use Sherlock. And hopefully it will push other auditors to also have to have skin in the game after their audits. You know, I think that's a hugely important thing that's still missing from the space, that Sherlock has always been it's always been one of the main things that we focused on. Like we were less interested in auditing and we were more interested in having that skin in the game and having that coverage and whatnot from the very start. And so yeah, I would hope that, you know, Sherlock sees a lot of success in that model so that it will push other auditors to also have to figure out, hey, how can we have skin in the game behind our audits? How can we make sure that our incentives are aligned with protocol teams? Because like I said, I think there's a lot of audit firms out there that are not being held fully accountable in terms of maximizing their efficacy.
Yeah, what do you think that I'm just trying to word this question in a way that makes sense. Do you know what projects think about giving such a big part of the pot to just one auditor? Is that something they welcome? Is that something that they question?
Yeah, this is one of the controversial questions that people were asking about on Twitter, huh? So yeah, I guess to give some background there, as we talked about before, Sherlock tries to be kind of the best of both worlds, which means having the best parts of traditional audit, having the best parts of an audit contest. One of the pieces of audit contest that can be less than ideal is you don't actually know that a really strong security expert is going to show up and put all of their attention on your code base, especially if there's multiple audits running at the same time. I'm sure you talk to a lot of auditors and some of them kind of, you know, skip around, look to try to find things in different code bases, or a new code base gets announced and they'll go do that because they're more interested in it and they'll leave the other one behind, you know, halfway through. And so Sherlock thinks it's really, really important to have like a baseline level of quality in every single audit we do. And the best way to get that is to reserve a top security expert to dedicate all their time to your code base, kind of like a traditional audit. Except the added benefit of Sherlock is they have to compete against everyone else. And if they don't do a good job, then they lose, they go down on the rankings, they lose their senior Watson status maybe. And so every single time a reserved top auditor steps up to the plate with Sherlock, they're like, this is the Super Bowl, you know, like this is game time. If I'm not doing well here, like I might never see the senior Watson status again. And so anyways, we think that aspect is super important. And that's why we pay at least one senior Watson to be the lead senior Watson and show up to the contest. And in order to, you know, you want to get the Roger Federer, the Rafael Nadal, the Novak Djokovic's of the world looking at your code base. You don't necessarily want to get, you know, the number 50 best person or something like that being the lead auditor, because, you know, as we've seen, some of these guys who are in the top are just, they're just insane. You know, there's that old saying of like the 10X engineer. I think in auditing, that's ballpark kind of true, where there's like an exponential skill level with some of these top guys, where you could have 20 guys who are ranked, you know, 50 to 70 and have them go up against one top guy, and the top guy is still going to find things that they didn't find and, you know, super critical things. So it's very important to Sherlock to get those top guys. You can probably see where I'm going with this. That means you have to pay them a lot of money, and that means you have to pay a lot of the audit costs to have those top guys show up. And Sherlock has experimented. We like experimenting with things. Like, this is a very new audit contests and whatnot are a pretty new design space. And so we've paid senior Watsons anywhere from $7,500 a week to $22,500 a week to show up. Super wide range. Obviously, when we were paying $20,000, $22,500, there were a lot of complaints by people in the normal audit contest because the audit pot was being given to those top, you know, lead senior Watsons instead of being put into, well, instead of staying in the audit pot. And so, yeah, and totally understand why they complain about that. And you know, from Sherlock's perspective, it's just trying to find the right balance there of how do we make sure we're getting one of those very top tier guys for every audit contest. And you know, when we raised the senior Watson pay to 20,000, 22,000, we actually had guys show up who hadn't shown up for months, like top guys. I think, you know, Watch Pug was kind of off doing some other things, and they said, "Whoa, you're paying $20,000 to show up now. We're going to come back and do this." And Watch Pug is one of the best audit teams in the space. So, you know, I think it was effective in some ways to pay that much to the lead senior Watsons. It wasn't popular. But, you know, we've since lowered that pay back down again. And, you know, Watch Puck has stopped competing. So there's some signal there of like, okay, if you lower the pay, you're not going to get some of those top guys every time. But we had enough conversations with enough of the top guys who said, look, still very attractive to come and compete on Sherlock for $12,500 a week because we know, you know, if we do well, we're going to earn 20,000 total or 22,000 total if we you know, earn enough from the contest pot. And I think that's one of the other magical pieces of Sherlock is you can pay a really top guy $12,000, $10,000 to show up, and that's not their market rate. But because they expect to earn something from the contest pot, they will show up for that amount. And there's actually a big synergy there in terms of you're getting the best talent that way because the individual competitors, they see this contest pot of like, okay, there's $50,000 in the contest pot. I can get as much of that as I can by doing well. And the lead senior Watson also sees that and says, okay, if I do well, I can get that too. And you know, sometimes they will do it and sometimes they won't because it's a competition and some people are going to perform better in different contests. And that's exactly what we want, is everyone having to maximize trying their hardest in every single contest, so that the most bugs are found for the protocol team. So to answer your question, Sherlock pays a lot of money to the lead senior Watsons because we really think it's important to get the best of the best showing up for every audit contest. And you know, any dollar that we pay to the lead senior Watson to show up is a dollar that's not going in the contest pot, and that's going to just be unpopular for people who are not getting paid money to show up.
Yeah, I think it's a really tricky balance to arrive to because, on one hand, you want to have the best of the best, but on the other hand, you don't want to undermine the whole contest model of bringing in many capable people and looking at the code. So
Right.
it's a bit of a paradox, and that's, I guess, is one of the challenges of the China being the middle between a traditional audit and contest model. And yeah, I think the only way to figure out what's going to work best is try different things like you guys have done. And like everything else, at some point, you're going to reach the most optimal kind of balance there. And maybe they'll fluctuate a long time. But yeah, from my perspective, it is a tricky balance to arrive to. Because you have to give some sort of, you're gonna make some sort of sacrifice one direction or the other.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And maybe wouldn't call it a paradox so much as just like how you have to strike a balance, you know, and you have to get that balance in the right way. Otherwise you're going to tip over on one side or the other. And I wouldn't underestimate the power of that synergy of, wow, you get to pay this lead senior Watson less than his market rate to show up, and you get to have this really large contest pot that incentivizes other people to show up. There's like a net gain synergy in there somewhere that makes it you're getting like the most bang for your buck, essentially.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, man, it's been a pleasure. I think we covered a lot of things, and there's sure a lot more that we could talk about. So, yeah, thank you for coming on and having this chat.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. Appreciate the time. Yeah, I'm still a little bit jet lagged here in Istanbul, but and I'm sorry the cupboards are bare behind me. I don't live here, but I would put something in there.